Hello, I'm Samaya. I'm from California. And I feel like science is important because it helps people. People always need a reasoning for everything and understanding to things that they can't understand. And so through science, they're able to, I guess, find their own higher power that's non-threatening.
So my name is Lizzie Tapia. I'm going into 12th grade. I go to Williamsburg Preparatory. I think it matters because I guess everything in life is in a way surrounded by science, like how human evolution, like science was involved with that. Climate change is also involved with science. Everything like that is involved with science.
Space, the final frontier. This phrase was popularized by Captain James T. Kirk, played by the actor William Shatner, in the original Star Trek series. Scientists are not only looking to space as the final frontier, but different classrooms. So how did astrophysicists use their super knowledge of space and physics to capture the attention of teenagers working remotely in a physics class I co-taught in? Let's find out. I'm Miss Mack, and this is Hall Pass Break. During the 2020-2021 school year, different scientists virtually visited the physics class I co-taught in. Two of these scientists were kind enough to do an interview. Dr. Ramon Lopez is a distinguished physics professor at the University of Texas at Arlington. He spoke about his journey into the field and the importance of being multilingual as an astrophysicist. First, thank you so much, Dr. Lopez, for being here. And I just wanted you to talk about your journey in terms of how you became a distinguished professor of physics at the University of Texas at Arlington.
Right. So, to become a professor is a really sort of long track. But, you know, I started off as a kid who was really interested in science and things like that. And my parents were both educated. Of course, my mom was a teacher and my dad was a doctor and a military surgeon. And so education was always very, very important. What I really wanted was a telescope because that was the time of the space missions. And we were actually living in Texas and on an Army base when the Apollo moon landings took place. And I remember so very clearly running out and looking at the moon through my telescope and, oh, they're really up there. Then going back in and watching them on TV and stuff. And that's really where my interest in space, I think, came from was the time of the space program, the Apollo and Gemini missions and all of that. And it's a really big deal. And of course, you know, landing on the moon. But then my dad got out of the Army and we moved up to Illinois and, I continued my interest in science, and that's kind of when I decided I was going to study physics, although I wasn't entirely sure what that was, but it seemed to be the most fundamental of sciences. And then I found out that you would go to college and get a degree, and then you go on and do more work and get something called a doctorate, a PhD. And so I announced that that's what I was going to do. And of course, my parents were like, well, that's interesting. But I'm a stubborn person. I continued to do that. And then when I went to university, that's what I studied. I became a physics major from the very beginning, never had any thought of anything else. Then finished undergraduate and, you know, applied to graduate schools. And that's when the old interest in space came back, and that's why I became a space scientist. The National Society of Hispanic Physicists is really all about that, and I'm the current president of the NSHP, and we understand that, you know, not all students come already sort of pre-wired into networks. A lot of minority students, a lot of students from disadvantaged economic backgrounds, they may not have people in their families who they can talk to about these issues, so they don't know, like, how do you go about, as an undergraduate, getting involved in a research project, because they don't know people who've done that that can advise them. Or, you know, what are the things I should do to prepare myself to be successful in graduate school, or for my application to graduate school to be successful? That comes from networking, from the social capital of people around you. And you know, that's one thing that I try to do in my career is reach out to students who come from backgrounds where they may not have that social capital. And then through organizations like National Society of Hispanic Physicists, we try to provide that networking and help them build their ability to be successful.
So my name is Al Duncan. I am a special education teaching assistant for Clarkstown Sound High School in Rockland County. I've been teaching for a year. I work with special ed, so I speak to my students in English, ASL, and Spanish. So there's a wide range of languages that we use, and the working with a child's first and second language is incredibly important, and working with them in a language that they speak in their home is also important, and seeing people working in different languages is accessibility. Like, if you can see it, if you can experience it, you can reach those students better.
You know, I talked with your students about, you know, who spoke other languages. And now, the international language of science is English. Okay. My colleagues all around the world speak English. Japanese colleagues, Israeli colleagues, Russian colleagues, Mexican colleagues, Brazilian colleagues, everybody speaks English. Everybody publishes in English. Scientific meetings in whatever country they might be are held in English. So people growing up in English-speaking countries have that advantage, that they are native English speakers. And so, you know, you should definitely press that advantage. And it's really important for any student who is interested in becoming a scientist to learn to speak and write English very well. Because how are you going to convince a group of your peers who are reviewing your proposal that your ideas deserve funding and as compared to somebody else's? So you have to be able to write well. But, you know, because we live in an English-speaking country, we got that advantage. But on the other hand, of course, as I said, science is international. So I speak several languages, and it helps a lot. It helps me when I communicate with colleagues in other countries. I mean, I have a colleague in Brazil. He's actually Peruvian. He and I just talk in Spanish all the time. And that's just the way we are. I have other colleagues who I'll speak with in Spanish, or some that I'll speak with in Portuguese, because my Portuguese is now really quite good because I go to Brazil so often. Or times that I've been to Russia. I mean, I learned Russian because I wanted to be able to talk to Russian colleagues in Russian. And so, you know, I can do that. So having those advantages, if you grew up speaking more than one language, as I did, you know, coming from a Puerto Rican family, speaking both Spanish and English, it's a huge, huge advantage.
And that kind of brings me to my question about us as teachers here below, bridging that gap, because at the primary and secondary level, it's really hard to get kids to engage in the STEM and find that self-discipline that when they're challenged to continue on. So what do you think that we as not just educators, but as a nation should do to try to encourage, you know, young people of all ages to be, you know, the importance of STEM and that it's a career that you can have in academics or elsewhere?
Well, it is a difficult problem, and it's not just a problem in the United States. It's a problem worldwide.
Okay.
The richer a country becomes, the less interested students are in pursuing STEM careers. And that's something that I don't think is going to change. But you do have some people who might be interested, and you want to nurture those people. You want to nurture their interests. You want to nurture their talent. And even for people who don't necessarily want to become scientists, who want to do something else, and there's so many other valuable things to be done. Having some appreciation and interest in science is just a good lifelong lesson, because science is all around us. It affects all of us in some way. So the place to begin really is with encouraging children's natural curiosity, because children are sort of natural scientists. They like to mess around with stuff and play with things. Unfortunately, many elementary teachers themselves are not well educated in science, and so they're uncomfortable with the topic. And they're particularly uncomfortable with saying, "I don't know." But actually, "I don't know" is the point where all science begins. And then you might even have teachers who are willing to do that. Unfortunately, you know, we tend to beat it out of kids with, you know, having them read about science instead of doing science, or simply doing canned labs as opposed to real exploration. Finding appropriate things that students can really collect information, investigate, and come to conclusions. That's really important in elementary science education. In fact, science education at all grade levels. And that's what the Next Generation Science Standards tries to lay out, is topics and kinds of things that are appropriate and that involve all of these pieces of designing and carrying out investigations and, you know, coming to conclusions and communicating them, asking scientific questions, all of these practices that scientists and engineers use. And I was one of the people who worked on that, the Next Generation Science Standards. So here at UT Arlington, I'm the co-director of our secondary science teacher preparation program called UTeach Arlington. We are one of 43 or 44 UTeach programs around the country. This started in the 90s at University of Texas at Austin, and we recruit science and math majors to essentially do a minor in STEM education, and they then go into the schools as highly qualified science and math teachers.
This conversation was just amazing. And I wanted to ask that last question about, you know, the challenges you faced and then any encouragement you have. I mean,
I'm a stubborn person. So that helps a lot. You know, I if I find something I like, I stick with it for a long time. This mustache has been part of me since I was 23 years old, because I grew a mustache. I decided I like the mustache, and so it never went away. So I'm very conservative in that way. I find things that work and I stick with them. Anytime I had difficulties, and there were plenty of times, like when I first went to college, that was kind of a rude awakening. It took a while before I could sort of get into the groove. But I decided that I needed to work at it, that I needed to change how I studied, what I did around that. And then I found what worked. And then it was, you know, A's, right? But I started off first semester on scholastic probation because I went from a tiny high school in a farming town to University of Illinois. And I just wasn't prepared. I didn't know how to study effectively. And so many students, you know, they're gonna hit a college or university and they're gonna find they're not prepared. And that's unfortunate, and it happens a lot. It happened to me. And what you can't do is say, "I can't do this." What you gotta do is say, "How can I do it?"
Erin Flowers is a PhD candidate at Princeton University. She's another scientist who visited the classroom, and she opened up about the influence of Neil deGrasse Tyson and the importance of inclusivity in science.
Yeah, so my name is Erin Flowers. I'm a fifth year PhD student at Princeton Astrophysics. And for my thesis, I am studying Titan and Europa, which are moons of Saturn and Jupiter, respectively. I study their atmospheres in order to determine whether or not the conditions are conducive for life on those two moons of the solar system.
Nice. How did you get to where you are in grad school at Princeton?
Yeah. So honestly, I was always kind of like a nerdy little kid. I grew up in like the rural boonies of Florida for like the first 10 years of my life before moving back to the Midwest, to Michigan. Where my family is from. And, you know, both places I always had like a great view of the stars. And so you know, at night I would like to go out and look up at the sky, and during the day, especially in the summer, like now, like some of my you know, strongest childhood memories are like going to science camp at the local science museum, and you know, like doing different units on different things. And I always loved like the space unit. And when I was in school, I was also really good at math and physics. I really enjoyed doing math and physics. And so it was probably around like middle school, honestly, like I'm a super weirdo. Like in middle school, I was like, I am going to study astrophysics and I'm going to make it happen. And I like am very stubborn, and I continue being good at math and physics. And so that's kind of how I made it happen. And yeah, I remember being like, I want to say like, this was after my sophomore year of high school. We were like doing the college visit thing kind of early because I have family here in New York City. And so we've been coming to New York quite often. And so we visited Columbia University here in the city. And one of my, you know, childhood idols is Neil deGrasse Tyson. And he went to Columbia for undergrad. And I was like, I'm going to go to Columbia and do Columbia undergrad. And around the same time, we were like, oh, Princeton's like a day trip to drive from New York City to Princeton. Let's go there. So we spent a day from our visit to New York to go to Princeton, and I spoke with Netta Bacall, who is the undergraduate advisor at Princeton. And I was like, you know, I really do like Columbia. I still really want to go there for undergrad, but I'll go to Princeton for grad school. And she was like, yeah, like apply when you're ready to go to grad school, and hopefully we'll see you then. So I was, you know, early high school, I was like, I'm going to do Columbia undergrad and Princeton grad school, and that's what it's going to be. And I did it.
And as far as, you know, when it comes to being astrophysicist, a lot of people are like, whoa, that's way out of my field, and I'm not sure about it. But why is this important to us humble earthlings who may not know about it?
Yeah, honestly, I honestly think it's so important, not just like for me as a scientist. I think it's important for like everyone to be interested in space because I think it grants a certain matter of perspective. You know, it's one of those few things where it's like, you know, once you get that far enough, like, perspective distance, all the little differences between us kind of don't matter anymore. And I don't know, I think one of the beautiful things I've learned from astrophysics is just how special it is that, like, we exist. Like, we all, as college students who study astrophysics, we all have to take a cosmology course. And a cosmology course is basically a study of how the universe got started. And it was really, really, really incredibly specific conditions for the universe to even exist in the first place, which is like, honestly, like super phenomenal to me. Like if a number was like ever so slightly different, like the universe as we know it wouldn't exist, like we wouldn't exist. And so just kind of having that perspective of like, yeah, we're like super duper small in the grand scheme of the universe, you know, we're not that important, but at the same time, it's super incredible that we exist. And we shouldn't take that for granted. I think that's an important perspective for everyone to have in order to like relate to each other and to learn to care about each other. And when you look back at like, you know, some of the greatest things that have united us as like, you know, Americans and internationally united us over the course of history, a lot of that has had to do with like space travel and like studying space. And, you know, I think when we all focus on like that kind of really large common goal, a lot of good things fall out of that. A lot of good technology falls out of that. A lot of good collaboration falls out of that. A lot of good relationships between different parts of the country and different parts of the world fall out of that. Yeah.
How do you think like we can go about making people, especially people of color, see science in a different light, not as something to fear, but as something that we should trust?
Yeah. So this is honestly a topic that I see kind of interacted with more in astronomy than in other fields, but basically people of color have been disenfranchised from science for centuries, ever since, you know, the age of empires, basically, where you had a European way of doing science take over all the other traditional systems of science, because, you know, communities of color have been doing science for thousands of years. Like astronomy is one of the oldest forms of science. You know, we know that, you know, the ancient Egyptians did astronomy, we know that, you know, the ancient Incans and Mayans did astronomy. Like across the globe, people have been doing science for thousands of years. And when you had, you know, colonial powers come in and say, this is the way we have to do science, it completely like neglected the established traditions of science. And I think that is kind of like the seed of distrust amongst, you know, at least communities of color when it comes to doing science. And so I think one of the ways to bring communities of color back into science is to bring back and acknowledge those like ethnic ways of conducting science, which is a movement that is happening in astronomy, I'm really happy to say, especially in places where, you know, we have telescopes that are on indigenous land. And, you know, that is for a long, long time, like it just was taken for granted that we, you know, we're doing science on indigenous land without inviting the indigenous people to partake. But now we are, I think the newer generations of people who are like at the forefront of astronomy are respectful of that and trying to like remedy that history. And part of that is bringing back indigenous ways of conducting science. So for example, in Hawaii, where you know some of the biggest telescopes in the world are, there's a whole community project around teaching astronomy in the native Hawaiian language and trying to like bring back those oral traditions of conducting astronomy in like the native Hawaiian way. And so there's very similar things that I've seen for like the African American community. So, you know, our slave ancestors had to have a very precise knowledge of the stars in order to escape to freedom. And so bringing that narrative back in is really important to, you know, say, you know, science is for everyone. We don't have to do it in this one way. And we acknowledge that you have intelligence and we acknowledge that your intelligence is also important to, you know, adding to the human body of knowledge.
Right, you mentioned the language aspect, which I think is really important when it comes to science. Yeah. The fact that in Hawaii they are teaching kids in their native language, that also makes a huge difference. I remember another physicist, Dr. Lopez, astrophysicist, sorry, he came and visited our classroom and talked about, you know, being multilingual. So there is an important part, and I'm glad that you talked about that and the representation some, but we don't really talk about the indigenous community, and that can trickle down into a child saying, well, why should I study science when it doesn't reflect me?
Right. And like, you know, so this is one thing that we have done is like we, back in the before times, had people come to our observatory. We have like a tiny little telescope at our department. And I think this happened in my undergrad too, even though in New York City, you can imagine it's like harder to see the stars, but there would be Spanish public observing nights. So our volunteer operators who could speak Spanish would like conduct the entire night in Spanish. We're going to try to do like Chinese, Chinese language nights as well for our public observing. But I mean, this was like a really fascinating study I saw about like physics, like learning physics. And even if you're not like speaking another language, but even if you're speaking in like, you know, AAB, for example, like if you're speaking in Ebonics and you're teaching physics, young African-American students perform better in like physics classrooms in high schools when they were taught in Ebonics versus in like standard English. And it's like, you know, that's just like a dialect of English. And like even just that like small change, you know, improved how, you know, young students of color were interacting with science and performing in science. And it improved how they viewed science. You know, they were like, oh, this is something that's accessible to me because you're coming and speaking to me in my language and you're meeting me where I am.
My name is Julian. I teach at Code Next downtown, and I've been teaching since I was in 10th grade in multiple capacities, but I started teaching full-time when I was for 2 years now. So studying physics helps you understand the world around you, and it can also transfer into like understanding how to understand other people. So if you're if you understand like certain physical aspects, then you can also blend in empathy, and you can actually give reason to like the problems that you're solving.
You know, speaking of Neil deGrasse Tyson, he's originally from the Bronx, and I know there was a book he's written tons of books. There was a book about people from the Bronx, and he was included. And I know he had to overcome a lot. But I wonder, for you, what you have to overcome as an astrophysicist, especially as a woman of color in this field, and how might others, like young people who are thinking about it, like what advice would you give to them if they're thinking about it?
Community, community, community. I think it's like so important to like have a community behind you because, you know, growing up, pretty sure I never had like an African-American teacher in science. Like I had them in other courses, but never in my math or science courses. And in my field in particular, like there are just not a lot of African-American people in general who are like old enough to like be professors in my field. And so, you know, there's like an upcoming generation like right above me that like is starting to become professors. And then there's like a very old like historical community of people who like, you know, like Katherine Johnson, who worked at NASA, but those are more so like engineers and stuff. There aren't a lot of like astrophysicists who are African-American. I think there's like a list of us online. And when it comes to like women, like Black women astrophysicists, there's like not even 50 of us who have PhDs right now. Like the numbers are very, very small. And honestly, like, I think that this is something that we're getting better at. There's a National Society of Black Physicists, and I had the immense privilege and honor to meet their leadership last Friday. And this is a society that's been around since the 70s, and they've recently started to really ramp up their mentorship program and to really ramp up their outreach program. And so, like, I think you're going to see more like Black faces who are in physics reaching out to the community and like trying to build communities, because, you know, the president of the society was like, yeah, like I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for this guy who was here with me also on the e-board. You know, like we met back in grad school at a conference, and like, you know, we were from different universities, and, you know, we were at universities where people didn't really look like us, but we found each other, and we've been friends, you know, now for like 30 years, and like I would not have stayed with him. And so it's stories like that, you know, like finding that community however you can, wherever you can, is like what keeps people in the field, I would say. It's like, my parents like have no scientific background whatsoever. Like my mom works in television and my dad's a lawyer, like they are artists and historians. Like they're like, I don't know where you got the science from, but like, we are so proud of you. Like what you do sounds cool. I don't understand it, but like, good for you. And so, you know, just even having those people who are like, I have no idea what you do, but I love that you love it, and I want to support you on that journey, I think has been so important. And also, like, the teachers that I've had, even if they haven't looked like me, I was lucky enough to have, you know, teachers that saw that I was really good at, you know, physics and math, and who wanted to, like, nurture that, and who wanted to help me on that journey. And so, you know, finding those teachers, and honestly, one of my biggest cheerleaders was like my English teachers. You know, one of my English teachers, he was a Black man, and he was like, honestly, like one of my biggest cheerleaders. And, you know, that kind of support from just teachers, from educators, I think is like so, so crucial. Because those are the people that care about you as a person, not necessarily for like your grades or for like the skill set that you have.
So speaking of the classroom, I think what has been helpful has been people like yourself coming and talking to students. How do you think that's making an impact for communities of color?
Yeah, I think it definitely shows, you know, younger students of color that like this is something they can do. Like if they're interested in a field of science, they can pursue that field of science. And I think there's just like a lot of mysticism around like what it means to be a scientist and like the journey to become a scientist. So like I was out in Pasadena for a summer and working with a high school program, and part of the program was like, it was mostly like undergrad volunteers, and I was like one of the few grad students who was around working with the program. And even the undergrads who were from, you know, historically underrepresented backgrounds, so mostly students of color, but also low-income white students as well, or other low-income groups, had no idea, like, the process of, like, becoming a doctor and, like, going to graduate school. They didn't know that, like, you don't go into debt when you get your PhD, like, your PhD program pays you. And so I think that's, like, a major thing. It's, like, you know, young students of color think, oh, you have to do all this school, you'll be in debt forever. But it's like, no, it's not like becoming a doctor or a lawyer, which, you know, also incredibly important professions for students of color to go into. But like, yeah, those, you know, generate a lot of that. Whereas becoming a scientist is the opposite. I think it's important to go in at those stages because then they can see other people who look like them doing science. And they can hopefully, you know, be inspired to, you know, work with their counselors, work with their parents, work with their communities, to, you know, achieve those goals of becoming a scientist.
Right. And that even brings me to when you visited our classroom, I was taken aback by the fact that as an astrophysicist, you could go into baking and fashion. So
yeah.
Why, tell us how, you know, why that's important to mention to students about the field of science.
Yeah, so I think another misconception, and this is honestly true across the board, like I think like I have professors who have this mentality where it's like, if you're a scientist and if you go to grad school and get your PhD, your only destination is to become a professor at like a university. Like that is the only direction you can go. That's what my professors did. So they don't really have any idea that there are other options. But honestly, you know, the skills you get as a scientist are at the end of the day, just like really good critical thinking skills and really good problem solving skills. And those are so valuable across the job spectrum.
Well, the last thing I'm gonna ask, why does science matter?
Yes, science matters so much. Honestly, I think it's one of the most human things that we can do is to be science. Like, I don't understand, like, all this economics and, like, moving money around. Like, I don't understand, like, this. Like, all these other things to me just seem, like, so unnatural. Because it's, like, I think, when I was talking to a friend of mine who, she teaches little kids. She teaches, like, you know, fourth graders. And I'm like, you know, they're curious, like they're naturally born scientists. I think we're all born scientists. You're all born curious about the world and asking questions about the world. And I think it's just the most natural thing for us to be scientists. I just think it's honestly just the most human pursuit that we can do. And it's honestly, people are like, oh, why do you want to be a natural physicist? That's not going to like help humanity. And it's like, what are you talking about? Like all of the like, you know, think like sending people to the moon, like the technology that fell out of that mission, like you wouldn't have toothpaste the way we do now if it weren't for the NASA missions. Like, do you want to be brushing your teeth with baking soda the way like our grandparents did? Like, you know, just all the things that fall out of the pursuit of knowledge, like are honestly just like so valuable to like our quality of life and so valuable to like how we interact with each other and care about each other. And so I think it's just, it's the most natural thing for us to do, to be scientists. And so I always tell kids, like, whatever you're interested in right now, there's a field of science for it. And like, you should do it. Like you should pursue that because so many things come back to science. It's more than just what I'm researching. Science is more than just what any person research. It's like a lookout on life. It is a way of moving through life that I think is like super crucial. Right. And like one thing I often get asked is like, oh, if you're like a scientist, like that means you don't believe in God or anything like that. I was like, no, I'm actually like a very spiritual person. Like I think being an astrophysicist has made me more spiritual than some of y'all. Like, you know, like it makes you know, it gives me a certain outlook that is like, yeah, we should love everybody because we're all like the same. Like we're all on the same boat. Like, and I, you know, there are a lot of people in my family who I know who are, you know, deeply religious who don't feel that way. And it's like, maybe if you have a bit of science, it would change your outlook on that. So, yeah, I think it's just so important for us to be scientists for a variety of reasons.
My name is David. I'm from Brooklyn. Last year during physics class, our class had two space scientists, or like astrophysicists. It was really cool to have them talk about the general mysteries of space, kind of explain what goes on around there. And it did impact me just because I realized that we don't know a lot about outer space. Like, we know a decent amount, but there's still just too many unknowns, too many questions that are left that I feel need answers.
My name is Kevin Boateng, and I go to a university at Albany. I think that society can't develop or innovate or improve without science and technology. I believe that science is a very big part of the human development. And I also believe that humans are also in constant search of science and new ways to just figure out the world and how to make the world work and make life easier for us.
Astrophysicists are changing the world, whether it is through research, conversing with kids in their native language, or by finding ways for us to have an easier life on Earth with the invention of toothpaste. I hope more teachers allow students' curiosity to grow so we can create a more inclusive science community. This conversation took place last year, and while Dr. Lopez is no longer the president of the National Society of Hispanic Physicists, he is still a distinguished physics professor at the University of Texas at Arlington. Erin Flowers is continuing to work on her thesis as a PhD candidate at Princeton University. She's also working on the NASA Dragonfly mission, which is going to be a drone that goes to the moon, Titan. I want to thank Dr. Ramon Lopez and Aaron Flowers for taking the time not only to speak to me about their experiences as astrophysicists, but also visiting the classroom last year. Thank you to all the students and teachers who spoke with me during the episode. And thanks to my cheerleader and supporter of the podcast, Nadella Nakobe. Music was provided by Scott Nice and Macchiato Funky. Be sure to subscribe to Hall Pass Break on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. And you can follow the show on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok. The quote this week is by astrophysicist and author Neil deGrasse Tyson. "No one is dumb who is curious. The people who don't ask questions remain clueless throughout their lives." Thanks for listening.